This episode is brought to you by Radcasters Podcasting School. If you've listened to this episode and thought to yourself, I wonder what it takes to start a podcast, then jump on over to my website, radcasters.com, and click the events tab and come and join me on my upcoming webinar, Podcasting 101, which really covers everything you need to know about starting a podcast. So we talk about your who, what, and why. We look at the mic. We look at the space. We look at iTunes. We look at hosting. Everything that you need to know to start a podcast is within this webinar. So head on over to radcasters.com, click the events tab and sign up for our next webinar. See you on there. Today's interview is with Alice Nichols, and I just have to say, girl crushing hard on this chick. She actually emailed me a while back because she'd been listening to Carlosophies, and I just really dug her vibe. I don't even know how this happened, how I ended up sitting. Oh, that's right. She asked me if I would be on her podcast, Blog to Profit, and I was like, sure thing. And then while I was being interviewed by her, I was just like, this chick is legit the shit. And then I asked her to come on my podcast, and here we are. And listening to her story, it is so interesting. Like, this is why I love creating this podcast, because I get to listen to the stories behind success, and often they're not at all what you would expect. You know, Alice's story is littered with addiction, and it's just so removed from who she is now, this shiny, healthy, happy, hilarious chick. So this interview seriously has some gold, like worth its weight in gold. The story, the stuff that we talk about, the fear, there's got to be something in here for you for sure. Anyway, enough of me just rambling incoherently. Let's dive into the show. Welcome to Carlosophies, Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
So I'm going to go right back to my early childhood with my story, because I think I know that it helps to connect the dots with where I am now and how I live my life now. And I've made a promise, because I've been listening to Carlosophies for a long time, and I know that a lot of the women end up crying in the middle of their story. It's the only podcast I've ever heard where women end up in tears. So I'm not going to do that today. Just I'm telling you all we'll first. See. I'm going right back to my early childhood, because so much of it influenced, as it does with, I think, the majority of us, most of what I do now and how I live now in my life. So my parents were both hippies living in a teepee on the Clarence River in New South Wales. They had a generator for their kitchen, and they'd built the teepee themselves. So my mum had sewed the canvas, and my dad had cut down the pine trees and stripped them. And it was actually pretty incredible, the photos from that time. But, you know, mum was wearing white cotton and embroidered muumuus, and dad was in tight bell bottoms. Like he was this long, but they both had their hair parted down the middle. You know, they were Woodstock kids. And they got pregnant with twins, which was myself and my sister. My dad's parents were really particular about, they wanted him to go to school and study to be a lawyer. And he was smart enough, but he was surfing and, you know, probably taking acid every weekend, and as well as my mum. And so they were kind of not really into that, but they took the, mum, as she grew bigger and bigger, went back to Victoria so that they could do the right thing, or what my dad's parents thought was the right thing, and, you know, get a job and start working for the man, because this is what you did. So they moved back to Victoria, to South Gippsland, which is where we were born. Dad started working for minimum wage, 40 hours a week at an electricity company, and mum was doing the stay-at-home mum thing, which pretty much I think most mums did back then. So her mum's family, there's a really strong seam of alcoholism in the family. So two of her brothers, her sister, her dad, probably more, but nobody really talks about it, were alcoholics. And it is, I think it's definitely nurture, but I think a lot of it's also genetic. So mm-hmm. When we were about three, she sunk deeper and deeper into functioning alcoholism. So her and my dad got divorced when we were three. And so from that kind of time onwards, from three till about 13, my sister and I went through living with an alcoholic, which is, you know, this is going to trigger a lot of people who aren't alcoholics and who don't know alcoholics, but it's not a choice, it's a disease. And it is, you know, it's an incredibly painful disease for everybody involved, because as the person going, you know, as the person witnessing it, you cannot do anything about it. You can't just because you love someone, it can't change it. So, you know, if I look back and think of some of the more precarious times with my sister and I, you know, my mom, she loves us and loved us so much as you love your children, but that depth of love couldn't make her stop. You know, she was still making decisions that involved us that, you know, were light, that risked our lives, or that, you know, and it's really easy to kind of look at that and say, you know, that she's a horrible person, but she as a person wasn't horrible. It was the disease that was kind of really horrible. But so it was really interesting, because at the time, my sister and I spent a lot of our childhood being really mortifyingly embarrassed or humiliated at, you know, school events and things like that. But looking back now, there was something that was occurring that I am now incredibly grateful for, and that was that my mother, the alcoholic, was also my mother, the hippie and the earth angel. And so we were in the country, you know, had we been living somewhere different, the outcome could have been much different. But she was an alcoholic, but we lived on a farm and she grew her own veggies, and every single morning she made us a 3-course breakfast. Like, I don't know how she did it, but, you know, we'd start with a smoothie, then she'd make us a cold bowl of, you know, muesli, homemade muesli, and then after that she'd give us a hot course, which would be like tomato and onion on toast, or baked beans on toast, or eggs on toast, or something like that. It was just incredible. And then give us really beautiful lunches. You know, we were the lunches that we were embarrassed to have, which was like the, you know, peanut butter and grated carrot sandwiches, or salad and grated carrot, or skewers with fruits and veggies on them. Just the stuff that you'd want to hide while all the other kids were eating white bread, you know, ham and plastic cheese slice sandwiches. So she was this real walking contradiction. So whilst she loved us deeply and was teaching us about Mother Nature and the connection to the earth and growing what you eat, she was also, you know, really an emotional wreck and a physical wreck as well, because she nearly died from alcohol abuse when we were in our early teens. But so there's something that goes along with addiction and addictive behavior, which is that you live your life like Chicken Little, like the sky is falling. Mm. So you kind of live your life like every tiny little thing that goes wrong, and shit goes wrong in our lives all the time, is actually the most horrific thing that could ever go wrong in the whole world. And you know, you kind of crouch in the corner metaphorically with your hands covering your head. So we grew up with a mother who was, you know, she was on a disability pension, but a pension from, you know, Centrelink, from just being a single stay-at-home mum pretty much. But she also had really bad rheumatoid arthritis since she was young. So she was killing herself with booze, killing herself with this degenerative disease that was, you know, that she could definitely have helped, but the disease was kind of on top of that. And also subconsciously teaching my sister and I that we were living our lot in life. So I kind of grew up with this really deep unconscious belief, like I never would have recognized it until the last few years, that rich people were assholes, that people who had money or success or fame didn't have to work for it, that they were just lucky, that there was a class system, and that us living on government allowance in the country was just how it was supposed to be, and that we were strugglers, we were battlers, right? And so I grew up thinking we were always battlers and we were always going to struggle. And that was just like, I remember even in my early to late 20s, I still take joy in being frugal. There's a battler in me that still comes out in that regard. But it's also really detrimental to the like, she was teaching us we didn't have possibility, I suppose. And if she had known that at the time, she was just so deep in her own stuff, I suppose, that she couldn't recognize that. But it meant that when I hit my teenage years, putting my hand out for, you know, we were on Aus Study from 16, which is like the kids of people who are already on you know, a government allowance, you can also get a government allowance to support yourself after 16 because your parents kind of can't afford to support you as well. And so we were on that. So it was almost like, you know, some people who talk about government, you know, handouts or government allowance, they do talk about it being such a cyclical thing. And it really is, because I just had this, like, it was just okay. And I remember when I was a bit lost and I was kind of living up between, you know, Victoria and the New South Wales Central Coast when I was in my late teens or early 20s, and I was on the dole, and I think it was called Newstart. They changed it to Newstart allowance then. And I just really thought, like, that was just okay. I was one of those people. I don't know. And I had so much potential, which I didn't know about at the time. Nothing felt wrong about it. Like, even, and, you know, hate me listening to it if any of you do. It is a really deeply entrenched mind thing, and it takes a lot to get yourself out of that. So whilst I also wish that it might have, you know, that some people could get off their butts and do something, I do understand that if you're raised in a certain environment, that it's much more easy to sink into a mindset like that. I don't know how, why it happened. Mum and Dad, maybe both, they're super intelligent. I don't want to kind of, it probably came from that. But my sister and I, maybe because we were struggling so much at home, we started doing really, really well in school. So both primary school and then early high school as well. We were called teacher's pets a number of times. You know, we were two little blonde twins, identical twins. We loved school because it was a reprieve from everything that was going on at home. Like, there was a bit of physical abuse that we were seeing between mum and her partner, and, you know, there was a lot of, it was really just sometimes a not great environment to be in. So we were stoked that we had to get the late bus home. We would have stayed at school overnight if we could. It was just, it was affirming. You know, I've been reading about the types of different things that people crave to make themselves feel great. And I think for us, or me, I'll speak for myself, in my early childhood and even early teens, and now to some degree, having affirmation, you know, you've done good, or I'm proud of you, or something like that, was a really big thing for me. So I knew that every time I got an A on something, a teacher would tell me that I was good at it. So I would read the most books in ribbit competition, like 100 books in the first quarter of the year that I'd read, and I still read speed read to this day. Just stuff, like, I did everything I could to be liked by other people, I suppose, which is deeply ingrained in me still, I suppose, in some way. But of course, when you get to high school, then it was a different kettle of fish. Like, we went from this little country primary school to a bigger country high school, but one that was 30-kilometer drive away. And, you know, I remember being there in the first week, and all people were talking about getting on with each other, and I was like, I didn't know what it was. I'd never been kissed, and, you know, we were still 12, but everyone else knew what it was, and I was kind of, I don't know, I suppose we felt like these little country bumpkins. But it didn't take, I thought everyone was having sex. I was like, oh my God, everybody's having sex and they're 12 years old, they're all getting on with each other. But it wasn't that, they were all just tonguing each other and I just didn't realize. But I think that seeking that affirmation, you know, the A-plus student, the teacher's pet, the fess, I think the word fess was, you know, thrown around quite often. By about year nine, I'd taken that wanting or desiring to get that affirmation from teachers to wanting to get the affirmation from boys and my peers as well. So I kind of hit a period where obviously I'd had a lot of, by this stage, just to let you know, mum had been in and out of rehab twice and she'd been sober for 2 years by that stage, and she's sober to this day. So she's been sober now for over 20 years, which is amazing. She's phenomenal. Like, it's, that achievement is so, it's truly incredible. I completely went off the skids. Like, I fell in love with a bad boy, and I used to kind of say it was his influence, but it was really just that I was just looking for, I was looking for a lot of things, I think. Like, I was looking for affirmation, but I was looking to let go. I was probably looking to forget. I was looking to numb. And so from about 15 years old to about, there's a lot of things that happened during that time, but from about 15 years old, I started drinking myself. And I never had a healthy relationship with alcohol. As I mentioned earlier, for those in the know, you'll probably understand. For those who don't understand alcoholism, the studies show that it is genetic. There's a portion of it that's genetic. But obviously, if you're raised in a nurturing environment where you're witnessing a woman who doesn't have a lot of power or control and who uses it to numb, then it's an easier step for yourself to make. And you know, in my late years since talking to psychologists about it, it's interesting because, you know, there's two ways that kids of alcoholics typically go, which is, one, they step right into their parents' footsteps, or number two, they become very rigid or, you know, obsessive or anal about controlling everything. Mm-hmm. Control becomes a big thing because as, you know, adults in life, we struggle to deal with uncertainty, and being the child of an alcoholic, it's very uncertain. So I do have somebody close to me who went through it with me, who kind of went to the more, you know, the very controlling, but very organized, very obsessive, very, you know, anal type of thing. And I became the wild child. I became the bad twin. And I did things, you know, now looking back, there's a few things I was lucky to have survived. Mm. It was a rough time for me, but it was a rough time emotionally because I was dealing with, I had good friends. Like I look back and I think a lot of people say their high school years were their worst of their life. And they were and they weren't for me. Like I did have good friends. I did have good times. And I had been with this guy who I loved so much. But I loved him. I was obsessed with him pretty much, I think. So I would have done anything. I had so much stuff going on. It was a really weird time. So high school's rough, I think, for everyone. It really, as a mother now of two daughters, it just freaks me out. You know, you only want to do better than what your own parents did, I think, when you have children. I was intelligent underneath it all. So the year that I kind of went most off the rails was year 10, and I realize I'm going back so far, but it's kind of, I suppose it's needed to speak about where I am now. So when I was in year 10, I failed the year. And I had gone from an A-plus student to failing year 10. It might have actually been year 11. And I had to have a meeting with the principal, and I'd done okay until mid-year, and then I'd started, you know, delving into a lot of unhealthy habits and behaviors. And so the principal said to me, it would be, you know, we've discussed it up here, we've known you, you've been at the school for 4 years, and we know what your history is like at your primary school as well. I didn't know if they knew about my parental history or anything like that, but they said, you know, we know you're a smart girl. If we feel like if we kept you down, because technically we should be keeping you down, you've actually failed the year, but we feel like if we kept you down, you would leave and you would not come back, and you have potential and you're not, you know, we know you can use it. So I went back to year 12 and I did really, really well on all my written stuff, and then just kind of like didn't study for my exam. So I passed with like a 60 TER, which was like home and hose. I got into the uni degree I wanted, which was secondary teaching health sciences. And I just felt really, really pressured during that time, and I think kids still do. I felt so much pressure to decide what I wanted to be for the rest of my life, which is just one of those things that even now I think, how am I going to balance that with the way that I talk to my own children? Because it's like now looking back, that time meant nothing, and I wish that I hadn't had that pressure. I wish that I hadn't felt like I had to decide what I wanted to be. But I'd gotten into uni, and I was the first person in my family for a really long time to go, because I didn't actually mention that when Dad's parents were trying to get him to study law, he had started studying law. He'd gotten a scholarship to Melbourne University to study law, and he'd been studying it, and it was during the era of the very first Underbelly series. So it was like the 70s when all the cops were under the, you know, they were getting paid off and the drug lords were all big in Melbourne or whatever. And so he was working for the Melbourne Magistrates Court, and he said he's a lover, not a fighter, and he's also a very moral man, and he just couldn't believe the corruption. So he was working as a clerk of courts in the Melbourne Magistrates Court, and he quit and he ended up becoming a surfing garbo. So mum's like, he had the best body, but he had this job that his parents pretty much disowned him for just because of his moral stance. But so when I got into uni, it was like finally someone else, you know, one of the Buntings is gonna do something. And I was only really going because of the pressure, and I was partying so hard, and I just couldn't, I wasn't going to class. You know, I was spending a lot of time at a famous nightclub on Chapel Street here in Melbourne, and I was walking in on a Friday night and walking out on a Sunday morning kind of thing.
We probably part, you
we
know.
We saw each other paths. Through heavy lidded eyes. Look, and you know what, this is what I think about even now when some people, I don't talk about my story in depth as much anymore, but when you're that age and you're exhibiting really unhealthy behavior, it's not super frowned upon because it seems like everybody's doing it. So whilst I was, you know, taking drugs and partying and going nightclubbing, everybody else was doing it, but they were also not experiencing this guilt and this shame. And like I would go into blackout if I drank but didn't take drugs, you know, like just, I'm never going to share this podcast with my in-laws, but just, you know, I would go into these blackouts. And so I had, some of my friends were concerned about me, and I've since spoken to them about it. You know, in my late 20s and early 30s, now that we're all pretending to be adults. But I think they were concerned in the way that when they saw me and I would get blackout drunk, they'd be like, you know, this is not great. But everybody else, I was seeing them all when they were all drinking too. But what nobody could see when I was saying, I think I've got a problem, because there was a number of times I would say, I think I've got a problem, I need to do something about this. And I would try and I would fail every time, or I would feel like I was failing every time. Nobody's really like, they're all kind of going, yeah, right. Because they're not seeing you drunk on a Monday night. They're not seeing you at home on your own on a Monday night or a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night or a Thursday night. They're seeing you when they're out doing it. And when you're that age, it's like you're supposed, in Australia especially, like this is part of the culture, you're supposed to be doing it. But I was young, I was blonde, I was small, and I had a good group of friends. And so it's a little like, you know, I often think about the difference between, you know, you can be a functioning alcoholic and you can look like everything's fine, and it's such an easy, a much easier thing to hide than the people who are sitting on the footpath, you know, sleeping on a piece of cardboard. But it's as life-threatening or as dangerous emotionally as, you know, both of those things are as dangerous emotionally. I ended up dropping out of uni, which I did twice. So first time I dropped out was secondary teaching health sciences. Second time was nutrition, food and health sciences. So I'd always had an interest in those things. I always wanted to finish them, but I just could never focus. I was always partying a bit harder. I remember once my uni, the girl who used to give me a lift to uni, to Vic Uni, I remember hearing her banging on the front door of the house one day, and I just couldn't get out of bed because I was so hungover. And that was a really typical thing. And so it's really difficult to do maths and chemistry when you can't even open your eyes properly. So, but I was working at a retail store, so it was a national sports activewear store. And then I just had this really interesting career, some parts of it just were incredibly lucky, like right place, right time. I was never not hungover. Like I was hungover about 100 days a year. I looked fine. I was wearing sports gear to work every day. Like I looked like the epitome of healthy. I was going to Fitness First gym, you know, four times a week to a pump class or a combat class, and then drinking my way into blackout every weekend. I was doing really well at work because of that affirmation desire. You know, they asked me to go from 2IC to manager really, really quickly at 20 years old, which is still, you know, hardly getting paid peanuts, but it was like a big deal at the time. I had another guy who was managing a store close who said, you know, I love the way you speak to customers. I love the way you work with them. Come and work from us. And it was just a better environment. So I went to another retail store and just happened to have these guys walk in who owned a sports action company, which did snow goggles and motocross goggles and sunglasses. They were looking for an on-road sales rep, and they also were like, they kept coming back in and they were chatting to me, and they knew the guy that was running the store. And then they just said to me, you know, would you be interested in coming and being an on-road sales rep, which was a role that when you're in retail, everyone wants to get out of the physical shop environment. Like everyone wants to get on the road. So it was a really great experience for me. And kind of from there, I just had all these really, like I was working really hard when I could, and then I was just functioning through when I couldn't work really, really hard, but the results were still good. And so I eventually ended up recruiting for other retail companies. And from that place in recruitment, I was recruiting for executive software roles. And one of the software companies poached me to come and work as a sales executive there. And so I was selling, it was a global tech company out of Seattle called Concur. And so I was selling, it's actually pretty interesting. It's going to sound really boring, but it was automated travel and expense management solutions. I know that sounds really boring, but it was really awesome. So the companies I was meeting were some of the biggest companies in Australia, and I somehow still whilst trashing myself on the weekend became sales executive of the year there for the company, and then got asked to come over to LinkedIn.com after 3.5 years, and they asked me a few times, and I ended up having about 10 interviews with them. I eventually moved over to them because the recruitment background and their software as a service background really matched what they were selling, which the solution we were selling actually is not one that most people on the front end of LinkedIn would understand. It's more to corporates from a HR environment. So I ended up going there, and that kind of rounded out my career experience up until the time I stepped into my home office. Yeah, so, and in recruitment actually, so 6 years or 5 years prior to working at LinkedIn, I'd met a guy called Cam at the recruitment company I'd worked at. I'd admired his calves as he walked past on his way to Muay Thai boxing class. And we had a drunken pash one night at a work event. And then a year after we bonded over a mutual love for really jokes that other people would think they would be appalled by. We bonded over tasteless jokes. And a year after he stopped, it was only the drunken pash. And then a year after we stopped working together, I had a joke sent to my inbox. And it was just so bad but so good. And I'm like, the only person that's going to get this joke, he's going to love this joke, is Cam. So I sent it to him and we went on a date that night and we've been together ever since. So he kind of, you know, he was with me when I went through. I wish I knew what that joke was. I actually have a feeling. It was a video and it was of just a man. I don't even think it's funny now that I think about it, but we were young. Like, it was a man and it was just his dick, but it was swinging around in a circle. It might have had a hat or streamers on it or something, but the song to it was going, "You spin me right round, baby, right round like a wreck." Anyway, so that's not even fun. I wish I hadn't said it because you could have thought of something way more funny than that. I don't know. It must have had writing on it or something. I don't know. Anyway, went on a date. We've been together since. So he's kind of been with me through the whole like corporate software journey. And what happened with the health thing? So I'm trying to it was when I got together with Cam, I dated a lot of dickheads and I'd chosen, and some of them were probably not dickheads in their right relationship, but I was not the right person for them. Like I think every relationship is some type of spiritual journey you have to go on or some type of journey. But there was a couple in there that taught me lessons that I'll remember for the rest of my life. And then I think when I got together with Cam, he was the first guy that just let me be my version of crazy. Like, he didn't verbally let me. He just held space for this crazy woman who was trying to figure out how to deal with these demons without even knowing he was holding the space. And all of a sudden, it just kind of the desire to try and work out how to not trash myself by continuing to trash myself and try not to trash myself, the desire to do that just kind of waned. And then we got pregnant, so that was like a forced surrender of the wine bottle. So we were pregnant within a year with Holly, and that was a really rough time for me from a surrender perspective, because all of a sudden I actually had to be, like, I'd been drunk since I was 15 and I was 27 then, and so that's a really long time to not really know who you are and to just keep waking up every day and just getting through the day. So all of a sudden I was forced to be with myself. That was really, I felt like an elephant with like 20 feet. I was really isolated during that time as well, because I would go out and try to go to events knowing I was pregnant. So of course it's normal not to be drunk, but to not know how to act as well, not being drunk. So I didn't see a lot of people during that pregnancy. And then when Holly was born, I think I got really wasted about twice after she was born. And after the second time, the ball dropped. Like that was it. Had this moment of just complete, I'd tried to stop drinking, or tried to moderate is the better way. Like, I was like, I can moderate. And I just had never been able to do it. And so it was just like this clarity. I just stopped drinking on the spot. Didn't feel like none of those excuses, none of that inner voice existed in my mind again. And during that time, you know, I had also begun studying at IIN. As you know, I had that. I'd been at, I'd gone to uni literally to study health sciences twice, and I dropped out both times. So it wasn't on a whim. It was a desire I'd had for, you know, since I was a teenager. And so IIN gave me a low cost entry back into studying health. And whilst I loved, like, it was definitely a pivotal moment in my life, because, you know, in the course structure, it said, you will start a blog in month 10. And so I was like, well, fuck that. You know, my type A personality, I'm going to start a blog now about it. Why wait till month 10? So I was working at LinkedIn, started a blog called The Whole Daily. I was going through my own stuff as well. So really just finding clarity for the first time in my whole entire life. And just began to delve into myself. Sobriety, I was probably not calling it sobriety then, because I never thought of myself as an alcoholic, which I definitely, I think I am, I suppose. Oh, look at that. It's probably, I've never kind of solidified it. So, but what was tough then was that the company I was working for is an incredible company. But if you, the environment itself, so most tech startups that grow really quickly like they did and like Concur had done, so they call it hypergrowth. They're getting a lot of really, a lot of smart, fast-paced, type A-driven individuals into the company, and most of them are between 25 and 35. And it's mostly, you know, it's definitely there's more men. And so the culture is really important. They hire on culture alone. You know, they want to make sure you know what you're doing. But if your personality doesn't fit with their culture, they won't hire you. So there's a lot of parties and there's a lot of drinking and there's a lot of work stuff. And it just wasn't, I had a kid, I was practicing sobriety, I was, you know, had all this health stuff going on. I was typing up little blog posts each week and it just kind of began to, it was not working for me. Like I was getting paid a lot of money. I was getting overseas travel. I had I was winning awards and stuff like that. And it was not making me happy. I know that's a story that you hear a lot, and it's one thing I look back and I think I wasn't even grateful for the money at the time. I was not grateful for the money, which is really interesting when I see it, because there would be people who would cut off a finger to get paid, you know, the money that those type of companies will give you to sell things. So when I was pregnant with Ruby, my second child, the whole daily had been going really well. And while I was pregnant with her, maybe a little bit before, I'd created an online e-course. I decided to monetize my blog, and I did it really badly at first because I was a sales manager working in an online environment type of thing, or for an online company, for a professional social media company, but I was not giving any of my 10 years of sales knowledge to monetizing my blog. I just didn't know what I was doing. And it wasn't until I kind of put all that together in one package that it really, really took off. But I worked my ass off. Like, I was working till 1 a.m. some mornings, shaking when I went to bed with fatigue or because I'd drunk too much coffee. Like, I was a walking contradiction from health term. I'd flipped. Like, you know, they say when you quit smoking, sometimes you pick up eating or something like that. Yeah. I'd quit drinking and I'd picked up working. Like, yes. I was working. I was hustling I was going to webinars every day. I was reading books every day. Like, my bookshelf is from that year. It's just every business book you could imagine. I was chasing, like, I had my people online, like Tim Ferriss and Gary Vaynerchuk and all of these people who I was following madly, like just desperate to learn everything. And it worked. Like, I wasn't surrounding myself with people who had any idea what I was doing in the physical sense, but my online mentors who didn't know they were my mentors were literally changing my life. So the whole daily ended up becoming a really profitable online health business, which was pretty awesome, you know. So, and I felt like, and I was, I kind of like had gone from this person who was quite dulled and numb, but I had a nice personality. Like, I was always fun and I always looked happy and I always seemed happy. But when I quit drinking, this clarity in my life was so extreme. I was like Maria from The Sound of Music. I was like on the hill with the goat herd. I was, you know, like a reformed smoker. I was like, oh my God, this is so fucking cool. Life is so amazing and you've got to be healthy and amazing too. And this is incredible. And my brain's never been alive and I've never had the space, like so much space, like all of these things that all of a sudden I realized I could achieve. And it was that from being raised with that subconscious belief, like I had, like there was a compartment that I could reach and I could never go outside that compartment. All of a sudden I had no guilt, no shame, no regrets. And I'd been living with guilt and living with shame and living with regrets for all of my adult life until that point. From 15 years old, I'd lived with so much guilt, so much shame, so many regrets. And life-threatening moments as well, like seriously life-threatening moments. And all of a sudden the world was just like, I was seeing everything in Technicolor and it was just so incredible, which drove me to want to help more people just feel well and get well. So, yeah, that's probably one of the reasons that the whole daily, I just had this, I wasn't going to give up. It was just going to be profitable. So I did so many things until it was. And then from that, I had been asked so many times by other people who either knew my corporate background and who were blogging as well in the health industry, or who had seen that here I was not knowing what I was doing blogging, and then, you know, a year or a year and a half later was like successful blogging, profiting from my blogging. And so they were like, how do I do it? And it's, I feel like it's such a cliche now saying, you know, now that I've launched a blog, I'm going to teach you how to launch a blog, because I'd actually squashed the idea heaps of times and I'd started doing it and then I'd taken it out of my services because I was like, it doesn't feel right. Other people are doing it. Plus also it was really, I felt like it was a real disingenuous message to give to people that were following me from a health and well-being perspective to start to talk about business coaching or making profit from a blog. And it was like, I don't think it fits on it. You know, this is a personal opinion, but I think if you've got a health and well-being blog, it's not the place to start talking about business coaching on that blog. But so I got asked for it so many times, and I always said to other people, your audience is telling you what they want you to create for them. Like, it's the bottom line. And I went to ProBlogger in 2014 and Chris Ducker got up on stage and he pretty much said that line straight back to me. He's like, your audience are telling you what they want you to create for you. So I got home and launched AliceNichols.com, and I've been doing that for a year. And that's awesome. So I'm going to say do as I say and not as I do. Like, I think it is incredibly difficult running two separate business topics. Like, I'm a brand. Alice Nichols, who I am, is completely the same across both businesses. The way I talk, the way I would run a webinar, the way I would write a blog post, it's identical because my brand is me. And, I'm the girl who stuffs up and is okay with it. I'm the girl that keeps it real or is authentic, who takes one foot out of her mouth to put the other one in, you know. But the two business topics are completely different, and that can be really difficult to manage. So it's not something that I would advise other people to do. But I'm actually not blogging at the whole daily at the moment. It's working for me. It's a great resource. People go to it on a daily basis, but I can't give it the space, which is one of the reasons that, you know, I say to people, do as I say, not as I do. I've posted one blog post every fortnight or a month for the last few months because I'm actually back studying my advanced diploma of nutritional medicine as well, which is way harder than I thought it would be. And I'm 2.5 years in, and I'm hoping to pick up another couple of units and bring it forward and finish by the end of this year or at least mid next year. So I'll get that bloody piece of paper like 10 years after I started, or 15 years, nearly 15 years after I started, I'll get that piece of paper, which it shouldn't matter to me, but it does for some reason because I never finished anything. And now I'm going to. You know, when awesome. You said to me, tell me your whole thing, it might take this long. And I thought, that my story's not going to take that long. Look at what happens.
It takes longer than you think. I want to explore a couple of things that came up for me. I mean, like, I, you know why I love doing this? Because everybody's story is also my story. I love that. It's like cool. When I hear your story, it's like, and it happens with every guest, there's mm-hmm. these little parallel points, you know? So for me, it was like, I went to uni, I dropped out twice, mm-hmm. I started doing teaching secondary as well. Mm-hmm. I spent most of my 20s drunk, went through a lot of dickheads. I was a sales rep too, which was dangerous because I was away from home making a lot of money and in an industry where there were a lot of men and there was a lot of drinking. So it was kind of, you know, there's been a lot of drinking in my story too. And then meeting someone who, you know, dug me for my individual flavor, mm-hmm. which isn't palatable to most. And having someone who has been along that journey with me. Now, I still have a drink, but I am certainly no huge drunken mess anymore. Mm-hmm. And what I kind of there's a couple of things that I wanted to ask you. So, you know, with Cam and this huge change that you've been through over the last however long it's been, 5 or 6 years. How has he come along with you in that journey? Has he struggled to see you go from, you know, because I mean, when you marry a drunken mess and then they're like the glistening, shining, healthy, sober, was he part of the mess story or, really. You know,
so,
like.
Cam, it's really interesting because, you know, and I don't think psychologists are for me, but I've tried them. I think I have this weird ability or behavior of winding myself into whatever they want to hear so that I don't actually get what I need to out of the situation. But what I have found out when I'm speaking about Cam, and it's something I've asked him of as well, is that he's never experienced struggle. He's never had anything go wrong in his life. And I know that sounds like a really blasé thing to say, but I'm only going to say it because I've said to him, you know, have you ever had anything terrible go wrong in your life? And he's answered no, you know, so I feel like that's okay to share because that's okay. How awesome if nothing like that happens. But one guy that I saw to chat to about, you know, because there's a lot of forgiveness that I probably still need to do with my mum, who I love very much. And I really am trying to work through that because I know how much forgiveness, how important forgiveness is. But one thing that he mentioned was perhaps Cam was such, it was more easy for him to give you space to work shit out because he didn't have a barometer that said what is okay or what is not okay. It was all just kind of neutral. I don't know, like I suppose that doesn't really make much sense. He was definitely into partying, but he was never like me. Like he was also really into sports. So he was doing triathlons when I got together with him. And then now he's finishing up cycling at the end of this season and he'll do it recreationally, but he's been competing in road cycling for some time for the last few years, last 3 years or so. So he's like, you know, he rides a few hundred kilometres a week and he's so fit that he's tired, you know what I mean, at the moment and working full time. But he, what was he doing in my messness? I embarrassed him so many times. Like I thought I would lose him. There were times when I would think he has to dump me, like in an early stage of our relationship, like he has to dump me. The first night I met his parents, I choked on a piece of Wagyu steak at the Stoke House in St Kilda. I wasn't actually even really drunk at the time. I got drunk later on in the evening, but I was drinking a glass of red wine, chewing a steak and trying to talk at the same time, which is typical of me doing anything. And I choked on a piece of steak and I actually, like this sounds silly, but I really thought I was going to die. I had green slime from the spinach I'd chewed up prior to the steak coming out my nose. Like I went from this moment of thinking, like, play it cool, everything's all right, just cough a bit and it'll come out and you'll be fine, to having the whole restaurant, like it's a classy restaurant, just thinking that they were witnessing someone. It was like, it felt like it was going for an hour. It probably went for a minute. So there I am. I'd placed this bit of chewed up steak into Cam's hand that had flown out of my mouth and into my hand. I had green slime running down my nose. I'd just met his parents plus his sister and her lover for the first time. And I was like, welcome to the family. Like, just ridiculous. He has seen so many horrible things and he's never, like, he's brought up with me probably three or four times, like, you know, do you remember what you did last night? Or it's really, he knows that it's really hard for him to understand the struggle of wanting to be able to moderate and not be able to do it, which is something that only an alcoholic or someone who has experience, or if you're not an alcoholic, it's only something that somebody who's seen or lived with or grown up with an alcoholic can understand. It's a really hard to understand position. So he's really just always, he has said when we've had a meeting with, you know, like another person, I fell in love with Alice for her spontaneity and her ability to turn on a dime and her passion. Like he fell in love with my Ra and I fell in love with his stability. And that's still what attracts each other to ourselves, and it's still what pisses us off about each other too, you know, like. And I think that's what happens in relationships, because I'm got, which is, but my Ra's a different Ra now, you know. My Ra is now, let's go camping for a weekend, I've booked it, you're going. And his stability is that he's the most incredible family man who's home by 5:30 every night and who, you know, has a goals sheet in the shower where he ticks off that he spent family time with the kids or that he's read them a book each day. Like it's this weird, like, life is just such a beautiful ebb and flow. But going back to Cam, you asked about him. I can't pinpoint what it was about him in the situation that allowed it to all be okay. But he's, without him knowing it, he didn't consciously do anything. He was just giving me the space, holding the space, and that was it. And I was just finally allowed to be me and then go, yeah, I want to be a better me. So it was interesting.
Yeah. I mean, Mikko has been the same for me. You know, I met him when I was in my mid-20s and immediately I was attracted to his calmness and my crazy. It's like the calm and the crazy, we balance each other out. So, you know, and we were just talking off air before we started about me going to M. Rusciano and how that kind of impacted me, because I saw was her and me yeah. as a similar kind of person. And I feel like I've spent the last few years on my journey of self-discovery from depression and anxiety to where I am now, really exploring and getting to know who I am, but losing a bit of the fun me along the way. Mm-hmm. And then it's interesting that this conversation has come up about, you know, the alcohol was never the fun.
Mm.
I was the fun. The alcohol was like something that enabled me to be a bit more fun, you know. And so, I mean, I still have a wine every now and then and occasionally one too many wines, mm-hmm. but it doesn't, yeah, it's interesting. What I'm trying to do at the moment is find the part of me that was the crazy and bring, it's still there, but I feel like I need to unleash the crazy a bit more. I feel like I've been suppressing crazy a little.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it happens not just across our personal lives but across our business lives as well.
Yeah.
Like I'm in this position where I coach women how to make a profit from their blogs. I don't coach them on writing techniques. I don't coach them on design. It's specifically if you want to monetize your blog, here's here's a way you can do it, you know. But most of them are really busy trying to be somebody else. And it's really hard to monetize somebody else yourself because it's really inauthentic. And we do it in our lives and we do it in our businesses. And the hardest thing is, like you said, you are the fun. It wasn't the alcohol that was the fun. All of the things that we do because we think we can't, like I can't present a confident person unless I pretend to be another person. You are that confident person there, but you have to give them the space to shine. Or you can't be that fun person unless you have a few boozies. You're that fun person anyway, but you got to give the space for it. And it doesn't happen straight away, whether it's business or life. It doesn't. Like I said, I felt like I would walk into a room and I didn't know what to do with my hands. I would walk around with mm-hmm. 2 soda waters in my hands because I was like, I don't know what to do. I do not know what to do. I don't know what to say. And I'd have those moments when I'd be in conversations with people and I'd think, they think I'm crazy. They think I'm like, I've just said something wrong. I'm saying too much. I'm saying not enough. I've said something weird. And I just would analyze everything. And then in the end, you reach this point in business or life where when you're being yourself, you kind of just like, fuck it. Like somebody's going to dig it. And the people that don't are the ones who weren't supposed to dig it. Like if every single person in the world wanted to be your best friend, you know, such a crazy scenario, but it's like we go out there and try and make every single person in the world love us for whatever reason, which is just, ugh, how tiring that would be.
Exactly. And I think, you know, for me, the depression and the anxiety were the things, like that was the height of me questioning everything that I said and being concerned about the way what people thought of me. Mm. You know, these days I definitely just could give less of a fuck,
mm.
you know, because I like myself more and I've gotten to know myself better. You know, there's still parts of me that I would like to bring in. You know, I've got this coffee cup that I've been thinking, oh, I really should take a photo of it, but I don't want to because it, I don't want to offend anybody because it says it's coffee time. Beep, beep.
I love it.
See, but you know, there's part of me that's like, oh, but if I put it on Facebook, people are gonna not want to, you know.
Some people will love you, yeah. But some people will love. Some people will love you more for it, and some people will hate you. I don't know. I'm like, you know what? It's not my goal now to polarize people, but I know sometimes I'm gonna polarize people, and that includes people close to me, and that's totally fine. You know what's interesting though? I have not lost a single friend since I've changed my entire life. Not a single friend. Like there's people that have organically we've lost touch, but not because I decided to start blogging about health and stopped drinking back then, you know, like nothing. All of the people that loved me still love me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
for sure.
They loved me then. Yeah. It's very interesting the way we censor ourselves, I think, sometimes.
For sure.
I'm really conscious actually now. I know you've got a daughter and she's probably not into, unless she's really gifted, she's probably not having full-blown conversations with you at the moment. Well, and you know, in the adult language. But I'm really conscious now of having 2 daughters about what they hear. So, you know, with things like I don't say anything detrimental or negative about myself in front of them ever. In fact, I go out of my way, even if I'm not thinking it, to say really positive things about myself. Like Ruby, who's 3, called across the road to me last night, "Mummy, you're a stinky bum bum." And I went, "No, I'm not actually. I'm an amazing, hot, powerful, phenomenal woman who's capable of anything." And it sounds so naff. Like, you know, I really put it on. Like, I actually go over the top with it sometimes. But I say it with such certainty that they can only grow up believing that that's true. And I hope that they do grow up believing that that's true about themselves also, because that's what I didn't have. So that's really important to me.
Yeah.
I probably am a stinky bum bum sometimes, though, to be honest.
Hey, we all are. I think we have to be a stinky bum bum in order to be.
Totally. I lose my shit twice a day. If I've got them all day, twice a day I will lose my shit.
Yep.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's on the couch.
Biggest fear.
I knew you were, I'd listened to your podcast, so I knew this was coming, and every single time you ask somebody this, my intuitive answer, and I go with my gut a lot, is I'm not scared of anything. I know, and I have kids, so I feel like there's a part of you that should say, you know, something happening to my children, but I have this really, and something could, you know, because life is incredibly uncertain. You have no idea, we have no idea what's going to happen in an hour. Like, anything could happen. We've planned something, I'm sure, but that's nothing. I'm not afraid of anything. And if the worst thing in the world could happen, which is something that I don't spend my time being afraid of, then I would survive and I would eventually thrive again.
True. So what do you struggle with?
Saying no and prioritizing. I still crave affirmation, and that comes with saying yes a lot. So I say yes to a lot of things that I should say no to. And then also prioritize the things that I either say yes to or that I put on my plate. And I really try and embody that Brené Brown quote. I fail at it quite a lot, which is choose short-term discomfort over long-term resentment. Meaning, you know, it's going to suck to say no to somebody sometimes, especially if you know them or you're close or they're asking you something that you know they really want you to do. But when you're in the middle of doing it and you're hating on them or being like, oh, my God, I should never have do this, like, you know, that's when you've just taken from both of your lives. So, yeah, saying no and prioritizing.
I think like that feeling that you then bring to whatever it is, that feeling of resentment or obligation or whatever that is, like that's actually energetically detrimentally worse than just saying no and then being initially pissed off for 5 seconds.
Totally. I need to practice it more.
Yeah, ditto.
I'm terrible at it. And I do. And the thing is that I do want to do everything, you know. I do want to say yes. I do want to. But I, from an emotional and physical health perspective, I cannot do everything. And I'm learning that because I've tried. I actually, in 2015, I was on the ticket to speak nationally at the Utopia Women's Wellness event. And around that time I had another few speaking engagements and mum became unwell, and there was just a few things. And for the first time ever, I actually went, you know what, I'm going to rip the Band-Aid. And I spent 2 hours, like things that I'd said yes to were really big things, like a national tour where they've put you on a poster. And I spent a morning sending emails and calling people and saying, I am sorry, but I cannot. And I specifically did not give, you know, as women, we tend to give the reason, because of this and this and this and this, I'm really, 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 really sorry. And this is happening and this is happening and this is happening. I specifically chose to not give a reason that would answer any questions. And some people didn't like that, which is really interesting, right? Yeah. Because it doesn't matter to you why I'm saying no. But I said no. I literally had to pull the pin on so much, and it was the most intense feeling and then the most liberating experience I'd had in my last professional year.
So what about failure?
Failures lead to success. Yeah. So, I mean, I know I've probably said the word fail a few times. When I say fail, it's actually, I should probably use a different word for fail in my regular vernacular, but failure to me is absolutely success. So I feel like it's light and shade and black and white. You cannot have success without failure. And the more that you fail, the more you succeed. And I love the quote by Michael Jordan, who's obviously, you know, anybody who is old enough would know he's the greatest basketballer of all time. But he said, I've missed more than 9,000 shots in my career. I've lost almost 300 games. 26 times I've been trusted to take the game-winning shot and I've missed. I've failed over and over and over again in my life, and that is why I succeed. And I love that, because it's just like, if you're not, and you know what, and we always used to say this at LinkedIn, like, you cannot make shit happen if you're not on the court. Like, if you're just sitting there going, oh, I hope nothing happens, or I hope the ball doesn't hit me in the head, like, the ball's never coming near you anyway, so who gives a shit, you know? Like, you've got to be out there for it to even, for it to happen.
Yeah. You were saying about the, like, you have to be on the court, right?
Yes.
So, yep. And but the funny thing is, like, we're so, when we're on the court, sometimes we're so worried about what the people off the court are thinking about what we're doing, but it doesn't even fucking matter what they think, because they're not on the court.
But they actually don't care. And this is really, really interesting. And Elizabeth Gilbert brought this up in Big Magic really well. And I find, I'm trying to find the balance with the way that I tell, because I coach women, and I coach women who are, a lot of them aren't confident to put themselves out there and market themselves. You can create a product or a service to sell online, and it could be the best product or service that exists in the world in that space or on that topic. But if you cannot talk about it with confidence, or you cannot market it appropriately, the person who created the shittest product, who can market it appropriately and talk confidently about it, is going to kick your ass. Like, there is just, I'm sorry, but that's 100% what's going to happen, right? Because if you can't sell it to enough people, then, like, it's like from a sale, I'm talking specifically from a profit perspective, creating anything, even if somebody doesn't buy it, is a great thing. But if you want to make a profit from it, but one of the things that I talk about with them, and it's finding that balance, is that you are an exceptional individual. You are capable of anything. You have unlimited opportunity, unlimited, like, you can achieve more than you have ever dreamed. But I want to let you know that even whilst you are an unbelievable, unique individual, nobody gives a shit about you. Like, if you put, because I know, you know, I've worked with women who put a Facebook status up where they're talking about that thing that they want to sell. And I've done this in the past. Like, believe me, I've lived through all of these as well. And it can be petrifying, is that they'll put a Facebook status up about something they want to sell, and it either doesn't get liked or doesn't get shared or doesn't get commented on within a few hours, and they take it down. They're like, oh my God, I failed.
I know. I see that happen all the time. It's like, just have the courage of conviction. Like, put it out there and stand by it. It doesn't matter if nobody fucking likes it.
No.
The fact is, the matter you was that you were confident enough to leave it there even when nobody did like it. I never delete anything off my page.
Even the picture of your coffee mug. Do not delete it. Just leave it. Even when the trolls are hating on you all day long, you leave that coffee mug there.
That's it.
It's so true, though. So whilst you're an amazing individual, please remember that nobody gives a shit. And even the people who do give a shit, I mean, they're all worried about themselves, but even the people who, like, even if you get a troll, the troll has forgotten your name the next day. Like, it's so ludicrous. And that, and most people who are so worried about, most people who worry about what other people think about what they're doing, and who allow it to paralyze them, are more frightened by what a stranger is thinking about them than by what those people who live in the walls of their house are feeling about them, you know, like,
and
what
even
really
how they're feeling about themselves. Like, oh, worry totally about how you're feeling about yourself.
At its core, exactly, exactly.
That should be your first thing.
But totally, it's all about you, and what the dog thinks of you is also very important. But no,
true.
It's 100. True. It's 100%. You know what, though, I call it the 10x rule, because breaking the barrier between your biggest fear, which is people not being okay with it, or uncertainty, because life is uncertain and we really struggle to deal with that, breaking the barrier is the hardest part. Once you actually do it, like, once you do that thing once, and I do it 10 times, like, anything that scares the shit out of me, I'm going to do it 10 times, because I know that once you do it 10 times, it's nothing. Like, it's absolutely nothing. And we become so fearful as adults, you know, when as children, we were in the present moment, doing the round the world on the uneven steel bars in the primary school playground, you know, it's incredible how much the older we get, and apparently the smarter we get, how much more paralyzed and stupid we become as well. Yeah. Oh, it breaks my heart, because we die. Unfortunately, we forget that then you go
and
on
then we have the regrets of the way we spent the previous 80 years of our lives protecting everyone from their own feelings about themselves.
And that life is, and it's another contradiction, because whilst I'm out there saying you are incredible, you are unique, you are amazing, nobody gives a shit, I'm also saying your life is over in a blip, make it count. However, just to let you know that if you start studying a degree at 45 years old and you finish at 50, that is nothing, you know, you're still going to be the expert in your field for the next 40, 50 years of your life, for sure. Like, it's long. You've got time. Fail often. Do lots of stuff. You know, that's why it really pains me to see the pressure that our teenagers are under to make big decisions. My sister's a teacher at a private boys' high school and she teaches VCE, and some of the pressure that the parents have on these kids to, you know, they want them to be doctors, lawyers, everything that's apparently, I don't know what they think those career roles fulfill. For some people, they're absolutely their calling, but it's a really interesting way that we look at success, especially in the Western world, and it's so damaging to our emotional intelligence and our emotional IQ and our emotional fulfillment, which in the end is where our happiness comes from. It doesn't come from the pay packet. I can tell you that because I've had that. You've had that, and it doesn't come from there, does it?
No.
Now I'm going off on another tangent.
I totally agree, because it's like, you know, why people want that for their children is because they want their children to be safe. Mm. They think they want them to be happy, but they really want them to be safe.
Well, it's a direct reflection of their own inability to deal with uncertainty.
Yeah.
They want to create something certain for their children. And my sister-in-law's a doctor and she loves her job. Like, that's, she studied and she knew what she wanted to do and she's working in that, and she really is enjoying it, you know, but she didn't do it because somebody said this is what you should do. She did it because she tried a few different, you know, majors at university, and then she found one that she really, really enjoyed, and that's what she did. But I think that, the way that you look at the world changes so vastly different when you have children, and I imagine every parent thinks, I hope to do as well as my parents did in the things that they were great at, and I hope to do super, so much better at the things that they sucked at.
Totally. So last couple of questions. Mm-hmm. What I might bundle them together, freedom mm-hmm. and success.
So freedom, so I talked about failure leading to success. So yeah. Freedom, and this is my big thing, you know, my Maria, I'm on the hill with the goat herd and I'm singing Sound of Music because my brain's clear for the first time in my adult life. Freedom comes when you realize that failures are success, because when you're not scared of failing anymore, it means you can actually do every single thing that you ever thought that you were never capable of doing, but that everybody else was doing and succeeding in doing. That's freedom. It's not being able to jump on a plane and blog from a resort. Freedom is the ability to, and you know what some people, and what I was scared of? I was scared of just being okay with living an extraordinary life, you know, a graceful life where I woke up and went into my veggie garden in the morning and walked the kids to school and worked from home, not a resort, and wore Nikes and, or, you know, thongs and not stilettos, and drove an old beaten up Mazda four-wheel drive and not a BMW. Like, it's okay freedom is not pandering to society's version of success. It's knowing that I can fail doing all the things I want to do and succeed. Then the more I fail doing the things I want to do, the more I succeed at doing the things I want to do. That's freedom. It's realizing that failure means success, I think.
For sure.
For me. And the vision. Sorry, I'm going to go on again. I'm going to go on. It's the vision. Oh, and I know this, and, you know, I get to say this, I suppose, because I see so many people at the start of a journey where they want to become online entrepreneurs, and the scary thing is how similar their visions are, all coming from different walks of life, coming from different ages, all of them female though, and except for one dude, and seeing how, and it can't be, I know it can't be because I walked it. That goal that you've just told me cannot be your goal. That's not you at your, you know, in your soul. Like, that might be the goal of 1 in 20 people deep down, but is it external? Is it, you know, if nobody could see you when you achieved that goal, would that still be your goal? That's what I like to say, because I know mine, if no one could see me, I'd still be in the veggie garden. But if no one could see you driving your Beamer or living in that house in that fancy suburb, would you still want to drive the Beamer and live in that house in the fancy suburb?
That is really a very cool question.
Mm-hmm. People think about it. It changes the perspective of so many people and what they want to do. Like an Instagrammer, Like if you posted pictures on your Instagram account all day long and nobody ever saw them, would you still be spending 250 shots to get that selfie just right? Yeah. You wouldn't give a shit.
Yeah, but the answer to like, would I still be doing this if nobody listened? Mm. Yes, because I actually just fucking dig the conversations that I have.
Yeah, totally. And I know it and I can feel that as well. That's like me. Yeah. I would still write. I would still want to help people. I'd do it for free. I do it for free sometimes. Every day, totally. every day I do it for free.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's where people get so caught up is that it needs to be making the money. Like your purpose needs to be making your money. My purpose is to make people feel okay about themselves. And I do that on a daily basis. It's what I wake up and I make Mabel feel okay about herself. I make Miko feel okay about herself. You know, like I want to make people feel okay about who they are and where they're at. Like if you want to change it, do something about it, but you are okay. And can I monetize that? Maybe, maybe not, but it's still going to be who I show up as every single day.
Yeah, there's going to be, I mean, see, I feel like you could monetize pretty much anything. But I think that unless in business, if you're talking about monetization, if it's in business, unless you conquer your mindset first, you're doomed to not be successful in it because you cannot, you could pay Tony Robbins to help you run, you know, you could pay a $100,000 success coach to tell you everything they know. And unless you work on your emotional shit, you will not be successful. You just will not. You cannot come to the table. You cannot come to your laptop or your microphone scared to press call or scared to press send or scared to you cannot come there on a day-to-day basis and not work on that and be successful and just rock up feeling small every single day, again and again and again. You've got to do something about it. Mindset, for sure. Mindset way before action in those regards, totally.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
I am spending pretty much all of my time that I'm not in books at the moment on alicenichols.com, but you'll find me on all my social at The Whole Daily. It's not a very big plug, I realise. I'm like, if you want to hear more, you'll find me.
The takeaway. Exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper, and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
So my takeaway for everybody listening to this, if they're anything like me, because I listen to this podcast, is that you're the only person who is responsible for your fulfillment and happiness and success in life. There's nobody else out there that owes it to give it to you. So go out and hunt for yourself amongst the reeds, and the closer you get to finding her or him, the more uncomfortable you may be at times, but the most liberated you'll be.
Thank you.
That's a really shitty takeaway. It doesn't make sense. They're like, that's like saying, crack open your heartfelt, soulful self. And my takeaway is just do you find that person, and you're going to have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable to find her.
Thanks for tuning in to the Carlosophies podcast with me, Carly Nimmo. Let's continue the conversation at carlynimmo.com. If you were a big fan of the podcast, I'd be stoked if you left a review. And if you want to hear more radness just like this, be sure to subscribe and spread the word. In the meantime, be real, be rad. Peace out.